chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Rest make to have in the middle. We are rest make to have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Coming up first, clip here is going to be Daniel Estulin interviewed by Alex. And they go back about 19 years. Charlotte and I also interviewed Daniel Estulin a couple of times on his Bilderberg book, and then also it followed up on his transhumanism book. But this is really insightful. I'm going to put this up as an embedded video, so you'll be able to look and hear the total interview. But there's only about 11 minutes here, but it's very important. And then I'm going to read part of what Rudolf Steiner said about people in the future will try to kill our soul. Now, that's what's going on in transhumanism. So here we go with Daniel Estulin and Alex.
So again, that's it. Again, they're talking about ecological crisis, climate catastrophe. These are the set phrases we're going to be seeing in the mainstream media. Again, this is not Klaus Schwab's invention. Preparations to build the world on the basis of these arguments began over half a century ago. We're talking like 1968 at the initiative of Wells, David Rockefeller. Okay, and the non-governmental organization, which they called the Club of Rome. That's when it was created. That's when the whole thing started. And the Club of Rome, again, was founded in April 1968 by Alexander King and Aurelio Pesci, and it followed the Malthusian theories with a view to what? To genocide. Okay? And who belongs to the Club of Rome? Oh, God, these are some important people in the West who are concerned about the world well-being. No. We're talking about members of some of the oldest families of the Venetian black nobility of Europe. These are the descendants of the richest European families of European class who controlled and ruled Genoa and Venice, going back to the 12th century. And so in 1972, 4 years after the Club of Rome creation, they published their manifesto on the plight of humanity called The Limits to Growth, where if we are to take them at their word, they said, well, basically, you know, the current situation, you know, especially with the demographic expansion in time of scarcity of natural resources, we cannot survive on the planet Earth. And so they said, in search of this new enemy, okay, they said, we come up with the idea that this enemy could be the pollution, the threat of global warming, water security, famine, and the like. And they concluded by saying, okay, that the true enemy of the planet Earth is us, humanity itself. And so if you actually go back to the Club of Rome, to the 1960s, early 1970s, they began to prepare a plan for the reset of humanity. And they specified what, you know, in the report, what this reset is all about. Number one, the introduction of control over demographic processes in the world to stabilize the population and to reduce the optimal number to a billion people. Number two, deindustrialization of the economy. Number three, erosion of the national sovereignty of the state. Number four, the digitalization of all aspects of human life and society. Number five, the creation of a single world state on the ruins of the nation. So you dismantle the countries, okay, and you create global government. This is the Illuminati agenda.
The globalists are not just depending on World War III to save themselves, but AI and robots. You harped on that 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago. Now it's all come true. How is that going for them?
Well, it's going well because, again, one of the things about the sixth techno paradigm is the key role for artificial intelligence in absolutely all aspects of our lives. It's not about, again, it's not about drones. It's not about robots. It's a new philosophy, Alex, of creating this ambience that doesn't depend on people. And so human beings are becoming obsolete. And so we, the people, we have to define what is it that we do better than robots? Because if we can, they will re-engineer us out of the system. Because, again, there's how many? 8 billion, 8.5 billion people out there. Collapse means 90% left jobless. And that's 7 billion people. That's dystopic world. It's all these, you know, films and books that, you know, science fiction books going back to the 1960s, they talked about this. Well, it's coming true. And also, so, and this is the reality. And also, so the elite, they understand that needs to be done. And that's one of the reasons we have, you know, the concentration camp without tears. We have the control grid. We have all this other stuff. But at the same time, they need to do this in an organized fashion, and they're running out of time. So what do the elite do? They create chaos. We know that. And so you substitute real values for false or superficial values. You substitute morality for immoral behavior. You create modern heroes based on superficiality, on promiscuity. And these are all directed processes. Because when your hero is a football player, Cardi B and her number one Billboard song, WAP, Wet Ass Pussy, or worse, Spider-Man, or Wonder Woman, or Ninja Turtles, or YouTuber who takes clothes off for her audience. Because being a hero, you know, we're talking about moral rectitude, and you lead by example. You improve the lives of people by your actions per square kilometer of space against nature. And global mafia, that's important, you know, to end this. Global mafia, they're not afraid of Trump. They're not afraid of Putin. They're not afraid of Xi Jinping. They're not afraid of any president or prime minister. They are afraid of us, Alex, the people. And the moral breakdown of a nation happens not from material losses, but from the lack of vision of a better future. And that's where we have to stay strong. Because we can and we will win. Because evil can never, never, never triumph over good.
Well, I am very honored to have an old friend on. I tell you, you blink and 5 years goes by. I've known this gentleman for 20-plus years. He is the consummate Bilderberg sleuth. He really took over for Jim Tucker as Jim got older and, you know, really would just kind of go and report on what Daniel discovered. Daniel Esselin also developed sources inside the Bilderberg Group, which is at top of the pyramid of the other globalist management systems. DanielEsselin.com on Twitter, Daniel Esselin, E-S-T-U-L-I-N. He has written a bunch of best-selling books. He's an expert on the globalist long-term game. And knowing him, gosh, it's got to be at least 20 years, and working with him on the ground many times, it is just crazy to go back to his books and go back to the things he said was going to happen about the transhumanism and the takeover of the energy and just everything. It's incredible. That's why everybody should watch the film. It's free online, Endgame. Like the end of a chess game, Endgame, Blueprint for Global Enslavement. So I'm going to try my best here, which I know in the old days, and I never stopped interrupting, to let Daniel Esselin roll here. I was trying to do it with Alex Rosen earlier, but he was stopping every minute. Great guy, a really smart guy. So I'm going to try to shut up here as much as I can. We're going to skip this first network break coming up, our break, and let Daniel Esselin roll with whoever he wants to start, because you've got Ukraine, and you've got the carbon taxes, you've got the imploding borders, and you've got the rollout of the shots and the lockdowns and just all of it. We're not in beta. We're in operational. And how is it going for the globalists? What's going to happen next? Is Elon Musk for real? He's opposing their agenda, at least openly. I mean, this is a big discussion with a smart guy. And if I let him roll, he'll really give us some incredible data. And then I'll have some questions later in the hour. If he wants to go more into the next hour, we can. So, Daniel, good to have you back. Amazing here, my friend. And let him have it.
All right, Alex. Actually, yeah, I've been thinking, like, you and I, we attended the 2006, I think it was, Bilderberg Conference in 2006. In Ottawa, on the outskirts of Ottawa in Canada. And before that, you had me on when my book came out on the Bilderberg Group back in 2004 and 2005. So, yeah, we've known each other for about 20 years. We've been at it for a really long time, haven't we?
Yes, sir. Well,
listening to what the previous guest was talking about, and you were mentioning the left agenda, that there were the leftists. With your permission, I'd like to explain where this entire movement, okay, came from, because I think a lot of people don't quite understand. We're not so much talking about the leftists, we're talking about the liberal, global liberal agenda, which is a global satanic agenda. But most people don't understand where it came from. They think it just came out because George Soros was on the scene. Actually, this thing goes back way back in time. So again, with your permission, if that's okay with you, I want to explain this, because I think people need to understand. So they have a better perspective of how this entire, you know, dialectic works.
Yes, sir. You are hosting right now. You got the floor. We don't go to break for like 20 minutes. You got the floor. Boom.
Alex, I love you, man. You know, you've been at this for a long time. You're my hero. And to a lot of people out there, for as much as they criticize you out there, the people who really understand what you've done, we're with you 100%. I just want you to know that.
Well, thank you, sir.
So listen, I'd say the early 1980s, American society was mostly conservative and middle class. That doesn't mean that they all voted conservative, but their values and their outlook on life was conservative. And so then the situation changed in favor of the liberals with the advent of Reaganomics. In other words, the beginning of the credit stimulation of demand. And since this mechanism, which was based on the refinancing of private debt, allowed for the creation of a very stable middle class, more than half of the population of the United States, in fact, not only the United States, but we're talking about America, served as its, let's say, social anchor. And the middle class, unlike the poor, is very interested in having a strong state, even if the strong state is controlled by the bankers, which is it is today. And so it was from this period, again, we're going back to the early 1980s, that liberalism, not in a classical sense of the 19th century liberalism, such as Voltaire, for example, but modern liberals, well, the gay parades, juvenile justice, sex change operations, pedophilia, which is about to be legalized the world over, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So this is the meaning of juvenile justice reform being implemented not only in the United States and Canada, but I repeat, again, in the entire Western world. Because again, you want liberal perks, you gotta play the game by their rules. And it was based on a very simple promise. If you want to live up to the standard of our middle class, support a liberal ideology. Actually, there were no pederastic values initially, okay, but guarantee standards for the middle class, like little house, little garden, little car, 2 week vacations in Disneyland, et cetera, et cetera. And the people bought into this whole thing, and it became unnecessary to think about the future, to think about children, to think about grandchildren, because it contradicted liberal values. So people began to live for consumption, live day to day, and waves of happiness swept across the United States. Okay? And again, not only the United States, but those in Europe who wanted to join European Union, etc. And of course, it was never explained to these people that the economic model that underpinned the prosperity was finite. True, it was long, almost 40 years if we go back to the early 1980s, but again, finite. And by the way, this period has already come to an end, and we're seeing it right now. But in the meantime, you have two generations of this liberal parasites, 40 years, went through severe brainwashing and mind-bending. And the problem is these people do not know how to do anything, okay? At most, they aspire to be a famous YouTuber, a sleepy Hollywood producer, or like so many other people, the name of freedom of expression. They want to show their breasts because they're free to do that and make money off of that. Okay, and most of them not ready to take responsibility for the world around them, which is again being part of being a liberal, including having children without that entitles having children. And they yearn for the safe spaces in college, teddy bears they can hug, and, you know, soulmates in moments of anguish, etc. But the concept of unlimited growth on a finite planet comes at a price. And so when the expansion ends and is ending right now, the apocalyptic collapse follows.
Very good discussion. Estlin is just a mind, a great mind, and he has the ability to really speak very eloquently and to the point, but very, very insightfully. You know, it's amazing what Daniel has done. But here's what Rudolf Steiner said in 1917, he was way, way ahead of this transhumanism, and he was talking about them coming up with some medicine or vaccine that would kill the spirit of our soul. Here's what he had to say back then. Yes, again, this is what Rudolf Steiner had to say in 1917, talking about how the people that are going to be sound will be the good people, but they won't have a soul or a spirit. Here's what he says. It is pathological for people to even think in terms of a spirit and soul, meaning in the future. Sound people, those that are in control, will speak of nothing but the body. It will be considered a sign of illness for anyone to arrive at the idea of any such thing as a spirit or soul. People who think like that will be considered to be sick. You can be quite sure of it. A medicine will be found for this. The soul will be made non-existent with the aid of a drug. Taking a sound point of view, people will invent a vaccine to influence the organism as early as possible, preferably as soon as it is born, so that this human body never even gets the idea there is a soul and spirit. So that's what he said in 1917. And I'll put that PDF up so you can download it, print it out, and distribute it to everyone. So these are important things, and we've got to continue to try to maintain some principles and some ethics. Oh, and talking about ethics, just recently this week, Adam Schiff was censored by the House of Representatives. And this is what Lauren Boebert had to say before the vote was taken, the censure vote, which did succeed. And then I'll play the Speaker of the House reading into the record the vote and saying a few things, being interrupted by the Democratic House members that crowded around Adam Schiff in support of him, supporting something. I don't know. It's just, it's topsy-turvy these days. But anyway, this is what Boebert from Colorado had to say before the vote about Adam Schiff.
And from Colorado, Representative Lauren Boebert.
Gentlewoman's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to my colleague, Ana Paulina Luna, for leading on this very important issue. Adam Schiff is a complete disgrace to our nation and to our Constitution. He put the American people through 4 years of an endless impeachment hoax that he knew from the beginning was a lie. He represents the worst of permanent Washington, using his position of trust to lie to the American people. He received intelligence briefings that other members and the public did not have access to. And he used this position of trust to lie and to advance his own partisan agenda. Schiff's disgraceful time in Congress has destroyed Americans' faith in our institutions. Today, I am proud to stand with my colleague and friend from Florida, Ana Paulina Luna, to try and undo some of the damage that Adam Schiff has done by finally holding this crook accountable. Today, we are saying enough is enough by censuring him, and referring him to the Ethics Committee. I told the American people that he had proof that the Trump campaign asking the Russians for help in a conspiracy. That was a lie. He claimed that he was not working with anonymous informants during the impeachment hoax. That was a lie. Everyone with common sense knew that Adam Schiff was lying all along, including the director of National Intelligence, Obama's former Attorney General, the FBI Deputy Director, and more. But Adam Schiff doubled down on his big lie, claiming he had a smoking gun, proof of a conspiracy. But the only conspiracy going on was his conspiracy to defraud the American people by taking down their duly elected president.
I yield now 4 minutes to Representative Boebert.
Gentlewoman's recognized.
When Adam Schiff got caught lying, he did what all liars do and tried to cover the truth even more. He even used his taxpayer-funded staff to ask Twitter to censor journalists fact-checking his lies. But Adam Schiff won't get out of this one by calling in a favor. Today, we are holding him accountable and censuring him for his lies to the American people. To restore the trustworthiness of the House of Representatives, every member should vote to censure Adam Schiff so that we can speak with one voice to assure the American people that these lies will not be tolerated. I urge every one of my colleagues with good and decent intentions to vote for this resolution. If Adam Schiff has a shred of human decency left, he would resign from Congress in disgrace. His tombstone should read of his failed career in Congress
time
and should be
expired.
One word, Liar.
Next coming up is what Speaker McCarthy read into the record after the vote was taken. He read the results. He was interrupted multiple times by the crowd that was surrounding Adam Schiff, still supporting him, saying nay, 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 and just horsing around and acting like a bunch of horses' asses and supporting these kinds of things like him. I mean, he really mischaracterized the collusion, that Russian collusion thing, and said things that were just totally untrue. But here we have McCarthy speaking, the final vote and so forth on the censure. But here we go with McCarthy, Speaker of the House.
The yeas are 213 and the nays are 209, with six answering present. The resolution adopted. Without objection, the motion to consider is laid on the table. House will be in order. The House. The House will be in order. The House will be in order. The House will be in order. Will Representative Schiff present himself in the well? By its adoption of House Resolution 521, the House has resolved that the House of Representatives censures Adam Schiff, representative of the 30th Congressional District of California. I will begin again. By its adoption of House Resolution 521, the House has resolved that the House of Representatives censures Adam Schiff. Mm-hmm. By its adoption of House Resolution 521, the House has resolved that the House of... I have all night. By its adoption of House Resolution 521, the House has resolved that the House of Representatives censures Adam Schiff, representative of the 30th Congressional District of California, for misleading the American public and for conduct unbecoming of an elected member of the House of Representatives, that Representative Adam Schiff will be forthwith present himself in the well of the House of Representatives for the pronouncement of censure. That Representative Adam Schiff will be censured with the public reading of this resolution by the Speaker. And that the Committee on Ethics shall conduct an investigation into Representative Adam Schiff's falsehoods, misrepresentations, and abuse of sensitive information.
Well, they finally got around to dealing with him, but he did a lot of damage. And what the falsehoods that he floated, especially on the Russian, you know, collusion, how many votes did that comprise to get Biden elected and other people elected over the years U.S. representative races and so forth? So there was a great distortion there and interference with many elections by false statements. So how do you make up for all of that? I mean, that's new. Now, coming up next is Tammy Bruce, and she's interviewing Greg Jarrett and Matt Whitaker, who was a temporary attorney general for just a short period of time, but a very stand-up person, Matt Whitaker. But here's what they had to say about the whistleblowers that were being punished, you know, up there by the very organizations they were blowing the whistle on. But here we go with Tammy Bruce and Greg Jarrett and Matt Whitaker. Here we go next.
Joining us now with Reaction, the author of Trial of the Century, Fox News legal analyst Greg Jarrett, along with former acting attorney general Matt Whitaker. Matt, I'm going to start with you. You hear Merrick Garland, if the statement about the importance of the Department of Justice, of course it is. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're concerned. That's why everybody's upset with what's going on. What he said was true. He's attaching it to the presumption, then, that you should not criticize it because it's so important. With everything we've now heard, Matt, what's your take on this?
Yeah, well, good to be with you tonight, Tammy. You know, this is directed to people like me and Greg that have been calling into question these deals that were made with Hunter Biden, the investigation into Donald Trump, and so many other investigations that demonstrate a two-tiered system of justice. And, you know, I watched the attorney general. He seems very thin-skinned and can't take the criticism. I mean, if he is above board, then he should have nothing to worry about. I worry the most, especially now, it's very clear that maybe Garland's not the one putting his thumb on the scale, but the assistant attorney generals for criminal, the tax division, and these U.S. attorneys in California and in D.C. that appear to have prevented Weiss from bringing this case that he wanted to bring, and it has now had to fold up tent and take two misdemeanor charges. It's a shameful chapter for the Department of Justice.
It is. And, you know, Greg, I know our viewers are smart and they're reading everything. And there's just so much to look at when it comes to the nature of what happened with this case. You've been, of course, on this for years, the nature of a double standard, of an unfairness in the legal system. And yet last night, you've got that same attorney general even willing to be in the same room with a man that had pleading guilty to charges. We had the whistleblower report. No one seemed to have a problem with that. It's an outrageous insult to the American people, as though who cares what we think?
You know, it was kind of like the wedding reception in the Godfather movie where all the thugs and crooks gathered together to celebrate. Look, the head of the crooked organization is Merrick Garland, and his denials are farcical. You know, testimony by the whistleblowers is compelling. They cite specific actions that were taken to shut down felony charges to protect Hunter Biden and, in turn, Joe Biden. mean, how else do you explain an absurd plea to two minor tax misdemeanors in the face of clear felonious conduct that would land anybody else in prison? I mean, how do you rationalize a five-year investigation that ignored brazen corruption? They weren't even allowed to open the laptop. So Garland's denials are completely dishonest. The IRS found that, you know, Hunter cheated the government out of more than $8 million in unreported income from his many influence peddling schemes, yet most of that is not charged, just a sliver of it are a couple of misdemeanors. I mean, look, these IRS agents, they're supervisory officials. They were the ones who were present during these pivotal meetings when their requests, for example, for warrant-based raids on Hunter's home and storage unit were denied, and they sat there and they watched and listened as this assistant U.S. attorney says, yes, we do have more than enough probable cause to do it, but we won't because the optics would be bad. Well, gee, the DOJ didn't give a damn about the optics when they raided Mar-a-Lago. Garland, yeah, you know, claims also that two Biden-appointed U.S. attorneys in California and Washington didn't stop felonious prosecutions. Right. Well, he wasn't there. The IRS agents were.
Yeah, you know, Matt, what's fascinating here is that you've got his complete denials on this aspect where we have, and these whistleblowers, just so that the viewer realizes, as Greg noted, these are high-up people. These aren't, you know, somebody who we wouldn't know or didn't really have access or overheard a conversation. These are individuals who were involved and have since then were removed from the investigation so that they know directly. Do you think that when it comes to the nature of this, because we're not even having an investigation into, you've got an extra $8 million, that we're not, there's no investigation into who did that come from and was that bribery? We also have lost that, unless that's continuing, and that seems to be debatable.
We have, and to the point, you know, these were people that were at the table, but this is not their first rodeo. I mean, one was a supervisory special agent, so they have done plenty of criminal tax cases. They've done plenty of felony criminal tax cases. They know how people are treated under similar circumstances, and not only did they complain to the investigation team, you know, they took it to Congress because they felt that compelled that this was so out of the mainstream of how cases like this have been done and should be done that they felt that Congress and the American people should know how extraordinary this case is. And they were punished. They were taken off the case. They were removed from the investigative team for raising this concern. I mean, this case, as we learn, and we need to, you know, Congress needs to get the U.S. Attorney for Delaware, Mr. Weiss, in front of them as soon as possible, so and hear exactly what he has to say, because he is the one that knows what he was able to do and what he wasn't able to do and who prevented him from doing it.
Yes, exactly. You know, it seems to me it's similar that it's like the Edward Snowden case, who watched James Clapper lie to Congress directly about what the NSA was collecting on the American people, and he knew that was false. And that's what compelled him to come out. Now, of course, we know what happened to him. That was another message to whistleblowers. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Clearly, we're just at the beginning of this. This is not going to be the end. Greg and Matt, thank you, sirs.
So, you know, this is going on. This has been going on for a long time. The corruption out here in our government and just across the board. Now Jim Jordan is questioning Durham about different aspects about his report. There's criticism that Durham delayed this to help Biden go in. And I believe that's what happened. They all ganged up against Trump. And I believe that Durham possibly, not proof, delayed this so that it would not help Trump. Because the report does help Trump. But Durham did not go after aggressively those key players and call them in under questioning and under sworn oaths. Questioning, so that this report is okay to a degree, but it didn't go all the way. So here we have Jim Jordan bringing out from the questioning of Durham some of the most important issues and questions. Here we go with Jim Jordan.
Mr. Durham, in the summer of 2016, did our government receive intelligence that suggested Secretary Clinton had approved a plan to tie President Trump to Russia?
Yes.
Was that intelligence important enough for Director Brennan to go brief the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Attorney General of the United States, and the Director of the FBI?
Yes.
And was that intelligence put then into a memorandum, a referral memorandum?
Yes.
And was that memorandum then given to Director Comey and Agent Strzok?
That's who it was addressed to, yes.
Did Director Comey share that memorandum with the FISA court?
I'm sorry, can
you... Did he share that memorandum with the FISA court? Did Director Comey do that?
I'm not aware of that, if he did.
Did he share it with the lawyers preparing the FISA application?
Not to my knowledge.
Did he share it with the agents on the case working the Crossfire Hurricane case?
No.
Didn't share it with the agents on the case. Can you tell the committee what happened when you took that referral memo and shared it with one of those agents, specifically Supervisory Special Agent Number 1?
We interviewed the first supervisor of the Crossfire investigation, the operational person. We showed him the intelligence information. He indicated he had never seen it before. He immediately became emotional, got up and left the room with his lawyer, spent some time in the hallway, came back.
He was ticked off, wasn't he?
Yes.
He was ticked off because this is something he should have had as an agent on the case, is important information that the director of the FBI kept from the people doing the investigation.
The information was kept from him.
Who's Charles Dolan?
Charles Dolan is a public relations person here in Washington, D.C. He had prior involvement, professional involvement with Russian government, representing Russian government interests. He was a person that was associated with Igor Danchenko.
He was also buddies with the Clintons, wasn't he?
He had held positions when President Clinton was president.
And their campaign advisory to Secretary Clinton's presidential campaign, executive director of the Democrat Governors Association, that's the same Charles Dolan we're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. And wasn't he also a key source for information in the dossier?
He provided some information that was included in
Ritz
the dossier.
Ritz-Carlton,
yes.
Stuff, the Manafort stuff. In the Crossfire Hurricane investigation and the Mueller investigation, when the FBI interviewed Mr. Dolan, what did he have to say?
To my knowledge, they didn't interview Mr. Dolan.
They didn't interview this guy? Source for the dossier? Key information in the dossier? Buddies with the Clintons? They didn't talk to him?
No. I mean, we report on that because even Christopher Steele in October 2016 identified Dolan as somebody that might have information.
I find it interesting they didn't talk to him. What, were there agents on the case who wanted to talk to Mr. Dolan, Mr. Durham?
Yes.
What happened to analyst number one? She kept pushing to talk to Mr. Dolan. She was ultimately turned down. What happened to her the day that she was turned down and said, no, we're not talking to Dolan? What happened to her?
At about the same time, she was assigned to a different project.
They moved her. They said, we can't have this. We can't have that. We can't be looking into the Clintons' buddy, a key source for the dossier. They reassigned her. And then what did she do?
She memorialized it.
She entered a memo to the file because she said, at some point, the inspector general is going to want to know this information. I'm going to make it sure it's recorded contemporaneously. She put it in the file. It's crazy. They didn't talk to the key source. They kept key intelligence from the investigators. This is how bad this investigation was. But here's the scary part. I don't think anything has changed. The day your report came out, 5 weeks ago, May 15th, you got a letter, Mr. Durham, addressed to you from the general counsel at the FBI, Mr. Jason Jones, writes you this 6-page letter, and he says, not to worry, everything is fine. It's all been worked out at the FBI. He even says on page 2, he says, had the reforms implemented by current FBI leadership, summarized below, been in place in 2016, failures detailed in your report never would have happened, and he underlines it. Said this would never happen because of the reforms we implemented in 2019 and 2020. And then he says on page 4, one of the specific reforms, he says, FBI executive management has instructed investigations should be run out of the field and not from the headquarters. That statement is not true. 5 weeks ago, the FBI wrote you and said everything has changed when in fact it hasn't. And a statement in there is absolutely false. And we know it's false because 2 weeks ago today, we interviewed Stephen D'Antuono, former head of the Washington field office, Mr. Durham, and here's what he said in his transcript. Head of the Washington field office, when the Trump classified document investigation began, he said, that case was handled differently than I would have expected it to be, than any other cases handled. We learned a lot of stuff from Crossfire Hurricane, that headquarters should not work the investigation. It's supposed to be the field offices. My concern is that the Department of Justice was not following these principles. Nothing is, and that's the thing that scares me the most. Nothing has changed. Mr. Durham, I'm just finished with this. 60% of Americans now believe there's a double standard at the Justice Department. You know why they believe that? Because there is. That has got to change. And I don't think more training, more rules is going to do it. I think we have to fundamentally change the FISA process, and we have to use the appropriations process to limit how American tax dollars are spent at the Department of Justice.
Durham's final report showed the corruption that exists. But you must understand that Durham's been within the Department of Justice and so forth and institutions for over 40 years. So he's a government. He sides with government. So his report did not vigorously go after these entities like it should have possibly. But anyway, I'm going to play and end the program with a couple of clips. You know, we've had this Wagner group that went on the rampage and started moving towards Moscow in rebellion. And Putin moved out to his underground retreat and waited at Valdai, I think it's called, is where he has a home in an underground, strong room. But Lukashenko, the president, the strong arm president, I should say, of Belarus is the one that negotiated with them and the Wagner head, and finally got it settled, and no one will be prosecuted, and they'll all return to their barracks and be shunned they'll exit. The ones that were on Wagner group, loyal to their leader, will leave and so forth. And there's some that I think that stayed with the Russian authorities, and those will be rewarded with some kind of contracts. But no one will get any punishment, and it's over with. And so Putin's regime is still intact. Okay, this was the first clip. It was an announcement came through Sky News. It was early on, and then I'm going to play a later MSNBC that elaborates a little bit more on it. But here we go with that first clip. That was the first announcement right out of the bag. Here we go next.
We just want to bring you some breaking news on the developments in Russia. We're getting quite a few news lines coming into us here, amongst them the Kremlin saying that avoiding bloodshed was more important than punishing people, and the Kremlin saying that it does not know where Prigozhin is now. That's the official line from the Kremlin, that they do not know his whereabouts, and they've confirmed that the Belarusian president helped mediate with the Wagner group. We know that he stepped in, and following those negotiations, Prigozhin decided not to march on to Moscow. The Kremlin are saying that Wagner fighters who did not take part in the march will sign contracts with the Defense Ministry, and also hearing that there will be no criminal case against Prigozhin himself. Any criminal case against Prigozhin will be dropped, and the Kremlin say that it's highly appreciated his efforts. No further detail on exactly what is meant by that, but they're saying that they highly appreciated Prigozhin's efforts, and the Kremlin says that the deal that was brokered avoided further losses, which is something that the Wagner leader himself said that he didn't want to spill any Russian blood and therefore would not progress onto Moscow. But the Kremlin has described today's events as tragic, but has reiterated that there will be no criminal proceedings against the Wagner leader or any Wagner soldiers that took part in that original march on Moscow. So that is the very latest coming into us from the Kremlin.
Okay, this is going to follow up this short clip with an MSNBC, a little bit more in-depth discussion about what went on. And what I said earlier, well, no one will be prosecuted. And I think the leader of Wagner is going back to the Belarus for sanctuary. And I think his men are in their barracks, and they'll be released by the Russians and to leave for leaving. They'll disband somewhat the Wagner group. That's what this was all about. So here we go with an MSNBC report.
All right, more on the breaking news here on MSNBC. We have some breaking news on this developing story today. Joining us now for the latest on this story, this conflict that's happening in Russian, within the Russian border, NBC's Matt Bodner in London. Matt, what are you hearing?
Thank you, Richard. Well, a very astonishing development after what's been obviously an astonishing 24 hours in Russia. Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner mercenary group that has been on the march to Moscow, says that he is standing down in a statement that was issued just recently on his Telegram channel, saying that they wanted to disassemble his group and that that is why they were marching. He understands now, though, that while no blood has been spilled so far, the time for bloodshed was coming, and understanding the responsibility of this, has chosen to turn back. Now, we are learning a little bit more from that from the Belarusian side. A Telegram channel close to the presidential administration in Belarus that is often used to issue statements says that Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has actually been negotiating with Prigozhin all day and convinced him to stand down. So a very unexpected development. Moscow, of course, already on high alert. A day off planned on Monday for a counterterrorism operation. Unclear what will happen now. We're going to have to wait and see if Yevgeny Prigozhin actually turns around. It does not actually look, I'd say, as if the crisis is over yet. A lot could still happen here, but a very surprising turn of events, to say the least.
Now, it's hard to know. You have two reports right now, right? One coming from Yevgeny Prigozhin, as well as you're getting from the Belarusian leader, right, saying, I got this done. Has this been a long, do we know anything in terms of how long this discussion has been happening outside with the Belarusian leader?
We do not, no, but suffice it to say the Belarusian leader, at least the reports that we're hearing from Belarusian journalists who are close to the Belarusian president, Lukashenko is claiming that this has been going on all day, that he was kind of doing this on behalf of Russian President Vladimir Putin. We do know that the two of them spoke earlier about the situation, so there is a little bit of a timeline match there. So we certainly can't, I'd say, it's possible that that's very much what has been happening throughout the day. There were definitely a few times where Prigozhin seemed to be taking a step back from his incessant publishing of very angry audio messages throughout the day, kind of reinforcing his message and urging his guys on. So something is going on in the background, it seems. We're not entirely sure what role Putin played in this. We still have not actually heard anything from the Kremlin on this count, but from Prigozhin himself saying he's turning around. So we're going to have to see what exactly standing down looks like. He's saying that they're going to return to their field camps. We'll see.
Matt, going directly back to the social media post from Yevgeny Prigozhin, is he saying this in a way that is calm, braggadocious at all? Did he win? Is this what's in it? It's obviously hard to assess all of that, but he did post something. He did pick his language. He has not come out, at least in a very sharp way, against Vladimir Putin directly in name, and this might be consistent with that. What are you seeing in his post?
So I'd say his tone continues to be angry, but there is certainly a little bit of a calmer tone in this later message. He's essentially, you know, he is agreeing to stand down, but he's pointing out that what he's done so far was in response, again, to an attack from what he says is the Russian Defense Ministry on his troops, again calling this a justice march, and refusing to take responsibility for being the one to start bloodshed between Russians. So he continued to have very sharp language. Just the way he speaks is very intense, and that's still in those audio messages, but definitely a step back from what we were hearing this morning.